can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down.
Hello, everyone. This is Kevin Annett. I'm reading to you today from the book Here We Stand, Summoning God's People in a Time of Judgment, from the section called Table Talk, which are some small 10-15 minute reflections based on the Gospels, but also my own spiritual reflections. First is called, What is this thing called the Jubilee? Or Doing More Than Proclaiming. It's based on the Gospel of Luke chapter 4, 14-21. Well, I was 4 years old when I first helped myself to the bread out of the baker's truck. My mother, always hawk-eyed when it came to yours truly, spotted my deed and confronted me as I calmly sat munching my prize on the sidewalk near our home. I was hungry, I replied in my infant voice when Mum asked me why I had taken the bread out of the truck. I didn't understand why something so obvious needed an explanation, nor did I savvy her attempt to explain the concept of money to me. My mother perhaps blamed this early formative moment for my later predilection to give away anything in our house that wasn't nailed down to people who needed them more than we did. Cutlery, food, toys, even Mum's favorite fondue set ended up in the hands of the local needy folks. Mum started locking up everything. And just imagine, back then I hadn't even started reading the Bible. My egalitarian streak only intensified when I had scripture revealed to me in Sunday school. Well, there it was, in black and white. God gave creation to all of us. No mention of cash or debt consolidation loans in Eden. And even better, not much later in the biblical timeline, the wandering chosen ones were told by Jehovah that every 50 years they were to pull a Kevin Annett and give away what they had to the needy. Land was to be returned to the original owners, all debts were to be canceled, and all the prisoners set free. God called that the Jubilee Year. Well, like all good ideas, it was never put into practice. Instead, the tribal Hebrews demanded a king for themselves and war chariots and other weapons of mass destruction to smash those no-good Canaanites into the ground. And guess what? For some reason, the new big-shot kingly rulers conveniently forgot about the egalitarian Jubilee laws given to them by God. Gee, now I wonder why they did that. But don't despair, people. A little while later, in a one-camel dump called Nazareth, along came a local yokel named Yeshua ben Yosef, whom the Greeks ended up calling Jesus. He had the cheekiness to stand up uninvited in the local synagogue one morning and announce, "Well, sorry folks, but I'm here to bring in the Jubilee. Not in 50 years, but now, right here. So say farewell to debts and prisons and land grabs and rich and poor." That's what Jesus announced. "That's all gone," he said. "We're living under a new regime, and it's called the Kingdom of Heaven." Or in Jesus' own Aramaic tongue, that meant the realm of eternity. And with that, according to the Bible, Jesus' neighbors proceeded to try to lynch him. But that had to wait a few more years to finally succeed. Meanwhile, Jesus wandered around the land trying to show folks in practice what the Jubilee meant, and that it was suddenly present right there among them. But when he went further and tried getting rid of the biggest obstacle to God's revolution, that money-soaked and militarized temple in Jerusalem, well, you know what happened next. And the same fate of crucifixion has befallen all the other poor people whenever they've tried reclaiming the world for themselves. Well, thinking back on my young self eating freely and unafraid from the earth's bounty and sharing what I had with others, I'm struck by how inborn is the Jubilee spirit within all of us. We're naturally inclined to use the abundance that is given to us by God and share what there is according to what others need, not what the market needs or the rich need. The world was made that way. It was placed in common without barriers, and society would operate that way if it reflected the mind of God. All things would be held in common the way all nature is. But since the world doesn't operate that way, but rather is ruled and torn by the satanic attributes of property, greed, and class division, and the war that must follow on that, the Jubilee reminder steps forward to get all of us back on track, even if we don't want to be. Once upon a time, humanity moved according to the earth's rhythms. We understood innately that our society, like nature itself, has to rest and lie fallow every few years to replenish. Inequality and oppression have to step back and allow natural justice to take hold again. The Jubilee Laws wipe the slate clean so that humanity can recover and survive. But we've fallen from that simple awareness. Nothing in our society, it seems, can be overturned or renewed anymore. And so a blast of change has to clear away all the old barriers. That's indeed the very meaning of the word Jubilee. It comes from the Hebrew word yobel, which means a trumpet blast, the kind that announces the dawn of a new age. In the Old Testament book of Leviticus, the people are instructed to, quote, hallow the 50th year and proclaim liberty in the land to all the inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee unto you. Unquote. Well, that very saying is inscribed in the American Liberty Bell in Philadelphia, and it served as the basis of a true republic under God, as established by the United States of America. A simple fact that heaven ordains and trumpets justice and equality for all people every 50 years. Well, Thomas Jefferson went even further than that, and he said to survive, the American Republic needed a revolution every 25 years. In other words, in each new generation of its citizens. The Republic had to renew itself constantly to survive. The divine plan is for all people to return to a level and equal footing with one another on a routine basis. But of course, the wealthy and the powerful and every ruling elite desires and works for exactly the opposite, and consider God's equality impractical and subversive and communistic. Nevertheless, the truth is proclaimed, but it has to move from thin words to thick action in order to be real. If Jesus' presence among us means anything, it requires that we embody the Jubilee Laws through a new visible arrangement, a new covenant that Christianity is wrongly reduced to a religious ritual rather than elevate to a social reality. Jesus literally did set the captives free, return land to landless peasants, and cancel the debts of anyone who joined his movement. Like any guerrilla leader, Jesus established a liberated zone and thereby overturned the status quo. That's why he was judicially murdered, and not because he declared himself to be a divine being. In the Roman world of his time, crucifixion was reserved for political insurrectionists and armed rebels, not for religious heretics. Today we find the same drama played itself out wherever we try to make Christ's way a reality in our world. The Jubilee vision is a keg of dynamite being deliberately contained within religion. But I know from having tried to make it real that when we unleash that dynamite and actually sit the poor alongside the rich and abolish the differences between all of us, the full weight of oppression descends on us just like it did on Jesus. Well, Thomas Paine said, tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. But in the Jubilee vision, we are assured that injustice is a human creation, not a divine one, and that human society, like nature, must recover its vitality and equality if it is to reflect the mind of heaven and endure. That was the essence of Jesus' message and mission. The Jubilee Laws are as necessary, as revolutionary, and as much of a threat to the status quo today as they were 2,000 years ago, especially to bankers, bishops, and heads of state. And so the vision and the purpose remain, and begin with something as simple as sharing out the world's wealth with those who have none. For that is our challenge today and tomorrow. Will we do more than proclaim liberty, but enact it among ourselves as the equal and free-born men and women that we are? And the second table talk is entitled, Those Who Know Do, Those Who Don't Teach, Living the Higher Law, based on the Gospel of John, chapter 14, 12 to 19. It was an unexpected revelation, like all of them are, and it happened in a dirt-covered shack on the Mexican-Guatemalan border. For there, among a tribe of starving families, and for the only time in my life, I met a people who lived in the heart and mind of God. The fact that they were Mayan Indians on the run from napalm and death squads didn't account for the special light that shone from them. Whatever it is that allows a people to retain their own soul and capacity to do right must have predated their sufferings. Their power felt very old. And with the wisdom of an ancient forest, that strength spoke to me in a twofold way, in a meal and in a speech by one of the Mayan elders. Before anything was said, we were fed, as was the Mayan custom. The five of us fat white people were given the best food in their destitute refugee camp, tortillas, beans, and a small pile of scrambled eggs, from the few chickens they still had left. We, the rich North Americanos, were to take the food that should have gone to those thin and sickly children who peered in at us with guileless eyes and curious demeanor. 100 of these children were dying every month from starvation and dysentery, but we were given the best food in the camp that should have gone to them. And in that moment, we saw ourselves for who we were, and the unavoidable truth shattered us. Thus were our lives overturned in an instant, laying us bare for what came next. He was a thin and aging man, a former peasant who served as temporary leader of the 2,500 people in the camp. He never said his name, which seemed unimportant, nor did he have a word in his Quiche Indian language for leader or spokesman, for they had no social hierarchy among themselves. Instead, they had only each other. And he said, "Our best people are always the poorest ones among us because they spend their days serving others. No elder is ever above his people. The ones who carry a title and who think only of themselves have all gone away from us. We know that if we do not serve each other until our last breath, we will have no future as a people." Those were his words. But one of my pale colleagues, a young seminarian who had turned up her nose at the meal we'd been offered, asked the man whether he was afraid of another attack from the Guatemalan army across the river. The question seemed to confuse him. But through the translator, he finally answered, "The soldiers cannot harm us because they can only hurt our bodies. Our real enemy is Xibalba, the creator and the destroyer who seeks out human hearts to devour. He tests each one of us to see who can be eaten and who stands in the presence of Hunabku, the only source, whose heart is our heart and who cannot be destroyed." Unquote. Well, my colleague didn't seem satisfied and she went away proverbially empty. But as for me, basking in the pure and undivided devotion of a poor man to his people and his gods, it felt like I'd finally come home. And the prophet Jeremiah wrote, "For see, the days are coming when I will make a new law with my people. I will put my law into their hearts, so that each of them will know me inwardly. And they will no longer teach one another, saying, 'Know the Lord thy God,' for they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. And they will be my own people, and I will be their one God." Well, the prophet Jeremiah, who passed on this message, might have been sitting with us that day in the Nueva Esperanza refugee camp, inscribing the words of God spoken from the mouth of a poor Quiche peasant. For the same news was present. The divine truth is made flesh now and needs no mediator or interpreter. No priest, no pope, no church. Nothing but God present in each of us. It's expressed itself in these people who do not teach or learn God's law, for they are that law. They are the kingdom of heaven, spread out on the earth as those like Jesus, serving with an absolute love and devotion to each other. The Quiche Mayans were indeed not simply followers, but intimate friends of God. Jesus put it another way when he said, "My only command is that you love each other, for greater love has no one than to give himself for his friends. And I call you my friends now, for you aren't my servants any longer. A servant does not know his master, but as my friends you know all that I have been given by my Father. For you are chosen to go out into the world and bring forth much fruit." Well, after I returned to Canada from the refugee camp a week later, it felt like I had left my home to return to the land of the dead and the dying. For nowhere in the 30 years since my encounter with the Quiche have I met another genuine people in God, a whole community stripped of everything and yet bursting with love and service. I've not met people who would willingly die for each other, except among the Quiche. For the pale ghost people whom I have tried to serve with some of the Quiche's own spirit are consumed with words and things and teachings to each other that come from nothing and return to nothing. If there's one continual theme in the Bible, it is that of the holy remnant, the ones who have been set apart to reflect God's law and purpose in the midst of a fallen human social order. Indeed, Christ and his few followers were one such remnant. According to Jesus' own words, he came not to redeem all of humanity. That's what the church teaches, but it's not accurate. He came not to redeem all of humanity, but rather to call out and separate the chosen remnant from a condemned mankind. The revolutionary biblical act has always been to refine that remnant and allow it to be a counterpole away from the satanic world spirit and its principalities and powers. Whenever we encounter such a remnant of the world, few of us are capable of recognizing them for who they are, unless we are a part of that same fragment of heaven, however unconsciously. Some hidden seed in our true heart then responds, knowing itself to be an orphan in the world and seeking its home in the heart and mind of God, as a salmon seeks its spawning ground. Indeed, our estrangement from the world is the first spiritual step towards entering a new kingdom of heaven, or in Jesus' words in Aramaic, the realm of eternity. I had such an encounter 30 years ago in a desolate corner of the world, among a people called out from the world's corruption. Something of the K'iche has always remained in me, prompting my own good seed to grow and pull me increasingly out of this world and its unchanging and irredeemable death and corruption. The Bible calls such a step the New Covenant, whose law and authority supersedes all human laws, governments, and religions. The question for those of us who have had our inner eyes open to this covenant is whether we shall live under its new jurisdiction or languish as prisoners under human law. Our answer is a deeply spiritual and personal one, but it is also just as deeply political. And it can only be demonstrated in practice, in the doing, as my K'iche friend showed me one day in April of 1987, at the end of one world and the beginning of another. Hello, it's Kevin Annett, and I'm reading to you from my latest book, Fallen, the story of the Vancouver Four, which is about four of my Aboriginal friends who were killed by the Vancouver police and others as a result of their public campaigning to expose genocide in Canada, both past and present. These four friends were Harry Wilson, Bingo Dawson, Ricky Lavallee, and William Coombs. And this is from chapter 3 of my book, Fallen. A quote first by Sir Edward Bulwer Lytton, who was the first colonial secretary and co-founder of British Columbia in the year 1868. Colonization is civilization. If we, the superior race, take the land of these savages, we must utterly destroy them, the previous inhabitants. I may have to employ the Colorado solution and order every white man to kill every Indian in this province. And Cowichan elder Del Marjani said in 2006, when I see my people coming out of the superstore every day, crammed with coke and chips and all that shit, I see the genocide worked on us because it's never stopped. It's a big soul-sucking machine that's eating up all of us. It always struck just before dawn. A sharp whistle, the shouts of gruff voices in the foreign English tongue, and the plague would descend. It went after the children, and it spared none of them. An old New Chelnuth woman on Vancouver Island once told me, we just sat on the beach for days and cried for our children. None of them ever came back to us. Many of those disappeared Indian children ended up in special hospitals whose existence will always remain hidden from Canadians. In the post-World War II years, when military research money was flowing in torrents, the doctors in those dank places normally had the cover of Canadian Air Force officers. This could explain their continual use of wartime aviation terms when referring to their little brown test subjects. Over coffee or when chowing down at the base cafeteria, the doctors would revert to their native German tongue and joke about the virgin targets that had just been delivered from the local Indian residential schools or Catholic orphanages. Perhaps their use of the expression was part of their adoption by the culture that had given them sanctuary after the war. For in the early months of 1945, Allied heavy bombers had annihilated in an hour many of their pristine hometowns that had been previously unscathed. Oberstleutnant Otto Rainer, one of the SS doctors who went by the codename Major Bob Armstrong, had his own reason for using the expression. He wanted payback for his barbecued kin. By 1953, when he was safely ensconced as a Canadian citizen, Rainer always requested of his RCMP handlers that Jewish children, as well as Negroes and Indians, be delivered to his laboratory at the Lincoln Park Air Force Base outside Calgary. His sacred oath, after all, had been taken for life. Dr. Rainer became a popular figure in medical circles and in the United Church hospitals, where so many Indian children like Harry Wilson were held and where so many died. Rainer became especially close to the RCMP officers who provided him with the backup required by his AAA security status, sanctioned by the Canadian Army and their colleagues in the Pentagon. And in the process, the SS doctor came to know a young policeman named Peter Montague, and other members of a secret cult society that met at the prestigious Vancouver Club at certain nights of the year.
The church provided Aboriginal children in Rayner's cages were useful in many ways, including at the Vancouver Club. But his primary interest was experimental. Even as he dissected and gutted them as he would a batch of gerbils, Otto Rayner was fascinated by the Indian children. In his research notes, he observed that the Aboriginals possessed a quality missing in other children, what he called a vital presence that allowed them to live longer under torture with their minds still intact. This trait encouraged the doctor to expand his research to engulf increasing numbers of Aboriginal children provided by the ever-obliging Catholic, Anglican, and United Churches. And so as the 1960s dawned, Rayner commenced his own fishing expeditions beyond Alberta to find the perfect test subjects from among the large pool of captive West Coast Indian residential school children. He had focused his experiments on uncovering and capturing that quality which, in the thinking of his kind, would allow a final, absolute control over the mind and soul of humanity. Rayner's utilitarian Canadian and American colleagues didn't share his quasi-mystical views concerning the soul and energy captivation, but they did appreciate how completely his methods wiped clean and refashioned the human mind and personality. And his experimental results had more than a military application, as those like my four friends discovered. William Coombs and Harry Wilson had exhibited the vitality so sought after by Otto Rayner and his team, for unbeknownst to the boys themselves, they were descendants of shamanistic bloodlines. The two of them ended up quickly in the special section of the R.W. Large United Church Hospital in Bella Bella, British Columbia, where they became guinea pigs in Rayner's use of psychopharmacological drugs to turn people into unthinking robots. Rayner and his colleagues, two other whitewashed Nazis called Dr. Heinz Lehmann and Ruth Kyander, who settled at Lakehead University in Thunder Bay, had pioneered the clinical drug called chlorpromazine. It's often called the chemical lobotomizer because of its creation of a state of mental disinterest without a loss of consciousness. Touted as a cure for schizophrenia, chlorpromazine actually wipes out critical reasoning and the capacity to act on one's convictions. In its earlier form, known as Largactyl, the drug was inserted into the drinking water of prisons and Indian residential schools to reduce the inmates to a state of mental docility and compliance. But while the effects of Largactyl tended to wear off after a day or two, chlorpromazine's impact is permanent. And one of the consequences of the drug is to engender infertility, especially among males. A mind-controlling drug that creates a populace of cattle-like slaves unable to question or to breed. Can there be a better solution to overpopulation and social upheaval in the minds of the wealthy elites, whose overriding fear concerns the future? Expunged from my own culture and immersed in the lives of the four and their kind, I encountered some of the human remains of Otto Rayner's experiments. The mosaic I built from their accounts revealed something far more heinous than any of us besides the victims could have imagined, a thing that has wrapped its coils around everything I once called normal. In the words of one who seems to know, Dr. Michael Persinger of Laurentian University, quote, "Within the last two decades, a potential has emerged to influence directly the major portion of the approximately 6 billion brains of the human species, without mediation, through classical sensory modalities, by generating neural information within a physical or electronic medium in which all members of the species are immersed," unquote. Well, personally, I've learned to turn off the internet. Occasionally, some atypical academic will rouse himself from his tenure-induced caution and venture into the field euphemistically known as genocide studies. The title itself is as ludicrous as the musings derived thereof, based as it is on the notion that one can analyze the unimaginable and categorize the unthinkable. But the whole exercise has an odd appeal to effete scholars and to my masochistic side. Once I tried to enter the discourse in this field at a Montreal symposium until my remarks caused the hall to resound with an awkward and sustained silence. I guess the genocide experts didn't like being told that they were full of shit. And yet the cold, dead hand of clinical research reaches everywhere, especially where there is so much to obfuscate. So over the years, the burgeoning discipline of splatter study, as I call it, has taken on a life of its own. Sage scholars purport now to know exactly why masses of people are deliberately butchered simply for being who they are. Even if the eggheads are accurate, the knowing hasn't slowed the doing by one bit. None of the experts ever asked why. I was an optimist for so long in my life because of my incurable romanticism, as well as my generally uninformed condition. But when the arrangement finally kicked out my teeth and gutted my life, I began to acquire some wisdom. For the first time, I explored the possibility that my species could very well be irredeemably self-destructive simply because it is its nature to be so. In that light, splatter study took on a new legitimacy for me, not as some masturbatory exercise by pallid professors, but as an insight into why humanity is an incurable self-slaughterer. For what we call genocide is neither a crime nor an aberration, but historically, it's a normative and legal tool of both church and state. Indeed, the targeting for destruction of other groups is at the heart of the practice of every major world religion, and has always been divinely sanctioned. Long before the God with us inscription on the Nazi belt buckle, or the Vatican Creed of Indulgence that cleansed Muslim and Jew-killing crusaders of all their sins, a millennial-old word named Kiddush set the tone for most of our slaughters, at least in the West. For Kiddush is the biblical Hebrew word for sanctification, as well as for sacrifice, the one being inconceivable without the other. In the thinking of our ancestors, even long before the Hebrews, we honored heaven by killing something or someone here on earth. We're sanctified and made right with God by the blood of the living, even by God's own dearest Son. And so there you have it. Genocide is a massive blood sacrifice by which cultures define and sustain themselves. It's the norm, not a crime. I had no way of explaining this to the four, or to explain that what they had endured and that still bled from their pores was simply business as usual. I could only remain around them by imagining and pretending that the ritual killing of their people by mine was a punishable crime rather than the way of my people. Maybe Bingo and the others knew the truth, but if they did, they never let it on to me. Regardless, the farce did not endure past the point where I awakened to it. And even though everything faded into mist, and the real past was erased, the erasing was forgotten, and the lie became the truth, the five of us remembered.
Well, so they decided to organize. I mean, it wasn't really a decision. It gets rammed down your throat. You can only take so much. Then I suppose it was a little easier to identify who the enemy was. The process a bit more subtle than these, the waning days of Babylon. Well, of course, then you didn't have free public education, at least not for our booming people. You didn't have mass media. Well, you had songs, you had stories, and you had conversation. See, today, well, let me put it this way. All of us assign blame in our own best interest, right? Well, if we assign blame in our own best interest, that means blame is relative. And if blame is relative, then one of the important functions in society becomes who controls the blame pattern. Why is it that large bodies of workers, like in my country, assign blame downward to some welfare chiselers down at the bottom, you know, they say, trying to get a little bit of something for nothing, and they never assign blame upward to the handful of big-time chiselers at the top that get a whole lot of something for doing nothing at all? Well, that's because the blame pattern is manipulated. Sure, through the public schools. You know, we give our kids over to that when we put them in public school. And then the public schools build in little automatic responses, levers and buttons. When they go into the labor force, you see, then the government reaches out through its media in every home and pushes those buttons and pulls those levers and elicits massive response for or against anything it chooses. Like I say, it was easier to identify who the enemy was. You're booming into the freight yards. You could see the private cars rolled off on the siding. You can see, as you were sweating underground, like in Butte, the mansions being built in a ring on the hills around. See, and the mansions working their way higher up the hill, the deeper you dug yourself into the ground. Okay, easy to see. And the solution was a little easier to see, too. You know, dump the bosses off your back. Now, one thing I should mention is this music is not great poetry. You probably figured that out right away, didn't you? Well, that's because it was real simple. It had to be simple because people didn't speak a lot of English or had never been to school. But it's not like your modern protest music, which tends to be introverted. A lot of it very poetic. Hard to understand, though. Middle-class music written for middle-class consumption because they got the bread to buy it, okay? What I'm saying, there's a lot of difference between how many miles must a white dove sail before it can rest in the sand and dump the bosses off your back. Now, that's your line in that song, by the way, an old hymn tune, What a Friend We Have in Jesus. The Wobblies like to steal the hymn tunes because they were pretty and changed the words so they made more sense. Are you cold, forlorn, and hungry? Are there lots of things you lack? Is your life made up of misery? Then dump the bosses off your back. Are your clothes all torn and tattered? Are you living in a shack? Would you have your troubles scattered? Then dump the bosses off your back. Are you almost split asunder? Loaded like a long-eared jack?
This is Kevin Annett. My lecture today is entitled The Purpose and Nature of Our Struggle. This is for those listening who have moved from theory and discussion to action. We begin with a quote from Sun Tzu in The Art of War. Whoever grasps and holds onto the essential energy, or chi, of a situation will control the outcome of any battle and the fate of any opponent, no matter how powerful they are. And from the Book of Corinthians, what is nothing has been chosen to bring to nothing all the things that are. Imagine for a moment the present global tyranny not simply as a visible system of corporatocracy, violence, and corruption, but as a vast energy transfer, sucking the vitality and life from billions of people and the biosphere itself into one massive machine. Call that machine whatever you like. Its nature and behavior is geared towards a single purpose, and that is the absorption of all life into itself. It is one enormous feeder, and we are its morsels. To first understand this simple truth equips us inwardly to stop this insatiable complex and our participation in it, far better than can mere political analysis. But understanding alone does not free us to act. All interactions in our universe involve an essential energy that guides the movement of every particle and determines every outcome. Sun Tzu called this energy qi. Plato saw it as a pre-existing essence behind the mask of appearances. Some people like to call it God. Regardless of its nomenclature, this source that binds our reality is like a mighty river which can either sweep us along helplessly or be utilized by us to alter reality. Every ruler understands this simple fact, even while the rest of us have been trained not to grasp it, and thereby are kept blind in a harness held by a few. Those who understand and utilize this qi are able to control the thoughts and actions of the multitudes of humanity, only as long as the latter are devoid of their own access to qi. The primary means of stripping humanity of attaining this normally inherent power is by using fear and trauma-based conditioning at a very young age to cause people to habitually surrender and defer at every level to some higher external power, and thereby transfer their own particle of qi to that power. Such an unending energy transfer from the many to the few is the basis of all elite rule in our world. And yet, such a system is inherently unstable, since following natural law, the nature of qi, as with any energy system, is to disseminate equally and be held in common, and not privately, a fact that invalidates as contrary to the natural order all individual rule, whether by kings, presidents, popes, or corporate oligarchies. We know from our own experience that the loss of qi from the many to the few is not simply unnatural and disharmonious. It is so constant and systemic that it cannot be resisted by individual effort alone, since our individuality has been conditioned to operate habitually rather than consciously. We think like we eat, automatically, and therefore without qi. For instance, when faced with political repression by the rulers, so-called rulers, our first reflex is to surrender our qi once again to them, by pressuring them to give us justice through ritualized protest and petitioning, or relying on their courts and government. We don't seem capable of shifting our attention away from the chi holders simply because we have no working experience of what our own chi actually is. And so, like any lost child, we cannot try to change our world without continually deferring to the so-called powers that be, whether that be a sympathetic judge, or a progressive politician, or even a spiritual advisor. Our imprinted slavery makes it impossible for us to collectively reclaim ourselves and our world. Of course, erasing a conditioned imprint may begin with the individual, but it is not manifested individualistically, but collectively. For collectivity is the nature of universal chi, which binds all phenomena in a mutual garment of destiny and interconnectedness. In any successful revolution, the personal awakening of individuals inexorably causes a collective ripple effect in many other hearts and minds that generates a new kind of group chi or group mind, one that is unalterably opposed to the chi of the rulers. This new energy system is a living and working counterculture that draws energy and power away from the rulers and their system and returns it to the multitude of the people, provided the people can hold on to it as a group by retaining their own new separate identity. The very nature and purpose of our struggle today is to achieve precisely such a new energy dynamic and allow all of humanity to reclaim their natural chi and the collective liberty that it bestows. This purpose must continually guide all of our thoughts, words, and deeds. Well, how do we apply chi knowledge or chi knowledge to our present situation? The Chinese general Sun Tzu, writing thousands of years ago, had the best practical understanding of how such an awareness of the essential energy behind reality can and must be used in concrete struggles, especially in war and politics. As he said in his book, The Art of War, quote, "Nothing is permanent in life except conflict and change. One either masters the chi of one's opponent or is mastered by it," unquote. If we set aside our Western philosophical bias that dualistically separates matter from spirit, we recognize that Sun Tzu is accurately describing the dance that occurs in any conflict with an adversary. For as he writes, enemies like opposites are mutually dependent on one another, being part of a greater unity and purpose. Thus, enemies are defeated not by their abolition, but by their absorption into a greater whole. Unquote. In short, we can win any engagement not by outnumbering or crushing an opponent, but by redirecting his own essential energy into the outcome we desire. Redirecting. A classical example of the power of such an approach is found in our own campaign in Canada to indict church and state for genocide. That campaign consisted of a few dozen of us in three cities, but it successfully forced Canada and the Catholic, Anglican, and United Churches to respond on our terms by admitting their crime and helping to commence their own dissolution. For by acceding to a new reality, the old matrix called Christian Canada surrendered to us its chi and helped energize our agenda of disestablishing Crown and Church, a process that is now continuing to unfold. This new power alignment is crumbling Canada and laying the basis for a new chi arrangement that we call the Common Law Republic of Kanata. What achieved this victory were not our numbers, but our strategic position, our visible persistence, and our ability to outmaneuver and redirect the chi of the system, armed as we were, but with an undeniable truth and evidence that kept both church and state constantly fearful and on the defensive. Similarly, but even more stunning, is the other greater victory that flowed from this first one, namely the blow against the Vatican and Rome, and our historic deposing of Pope Benedict on February 11, 2013, by our public conviction of him and other top Catholic officials for the same genocide. The successful mastering by us of a hugely more powerful opponent's chi happened because our small movement deliberately utilized a strategy of guerrilla warfare, which is summed up by Sun Tzu thus, quote, "First, when I am few and my enemy is many, I can use the few to strike the many, because those whom I battle are restricted, being larger and more unwieldy. Their strength thereby becomes their weakness. Second, do not respond to the ground your enemy has prepared for you, but instead shape their ground. Then they have no alternative but to be led by you, as if it was their own idea. Third, Hide the time of battle from an enemy, and make what he loves and defends your first objective. By aiming at and seizing what the enemy holds dear, their greater strength and plans are rendered useless, and they must stop and respond on your terms, no matter how small are your forces." Unquote. And so, in this manner, on March 17, 2008, during Palm Sunday services, two of our action groups occupied without warning the largest Catholic cathedrals in Vancouver and Toronto, making headlines across Canada with our demand that the genocidal churches be prosecuted and forced to return the remains of the Indian children they killed. We also announced that we were commencing an international court action to charge Canada with genocide. Less than a month later, the government announced for the first time an inquiry into the missing residential school children. This led directly to the official parliamentary apology just 2 months later, and the subsequent official admission by Ottawa that genocide did indeed occur in Canada. By striking unexpectedly at the Achilles heel of the main instigator of genocide, behind its own lines, amidst its most sacred ritual, we not only shocked and frightened the enemy, but created the field of battle, and forced our opponent in its fear to respond on our terms. We defined the field of battle. Since then, no one in Canada has dared any more to deny that children were killed in the residential schools, and that it was indeed genocide. A few of us thereby reshaped the national narrative, or in Sun Tzu's words, we mastered the chi of an enormous adversary and redirected it on our terms. Similarly, the shockwave that deposed Pope Benedict has continued to spread, forcing four other resignations by top Vatican officers named in our common law court indictment, and compelling an enormous and desperate public relations effort by the present Pope Francis to shore up Rome's collapsing credibility. What is this but living proof of the ability of a small force to absorb the chi of the biggest and oldest enemy imaginable, the Vatican Incorporated? Well, compare these stunning victories by a handful of people with the negligible results of many thousands of protesters standing impotently outside government buildings and waving placards, and thereby surrendering their collective chi once again to their adversary. For the unstated message of any group of protesters to some external power is this: we acknowledge your authority. You have the power, not us. All we ask is that you change things for us. Well, that's not change on the terms of the people, but accommodation to elite rule, regardless of the outcome. This impotence called protest, like voting or going through the courts, is in truth the clearest example of the energy-sucking nature of the machine that relies on such controlled opposition to feed its own chi. In reality, no such diminishing of people's own chi is ever required, for the ability of any size group to capture the chi of the government and any corporate regime has been proven in practice by us and others. In energetic terms, this constitutes a reclaiming of power in order to rebalance chi, whose nature is to disseminate and to be shared equally. This approach is the only sure means of changing the nature of power itself and bringing down tyranny permanently, and not simply changing hats on the heads of different oppressors. And yet, as we noted, understanding this truth doesn't automatically make it happen, for the simple fact that we are a very part of what it is we oppose. The symbiotic nature of chi. It's often remarked, usually as a justification for not getting involved in a radical movement, that all revolutions just end up replacing one tyrant with another. Well, from a distance, history seems to bear this out. The moments where masses of people shake off their chains and govern themselves directly and consciously seem to be episodic and brief. Most of the time, the masses appear to be like a passive herd led around by some elite or another. But this appearance is in fact illusory. People's acquiescence to a regime is not the same thing as them actively supporting it. People will act to change things only when they can see and feel that there exists a working alternative to the status quo. That is, only when they're able to recognize and establish their own new collective chi. But why does this not seem to happen very often? What is the bulwark that holds people back besides the obvious ones of fear and intimidation? These questions can only be answered in practice by knowing first the symbiotic and interdependent nature of all power and its chi. Just as darkness and light depend on one another and are aspects of the same phenomena, so too are opponents in any war or political change. Even the biblical war in heaven was fought between two types of angels, Lucifer, in fact, meaning being of light, Any struggle is ultimately a dance between the same entity wearing different masks. Just as chi, like water, always seeks the lowest and most common ground, so does any conflict. Conscious or not, both sides search for a new symbiosis by which both can survive and prosper. For this reason, it's impossible for any group of citizens to establish a new society within the framework and institutions of the old regime, since all of their thoughts and hopes are conditioned by it. As Frederick Engels observed so accurately following the aborted European insurrection of 1848, men always begin revolutions with their eyes fixed on the past. And the Italian rebel Giuseppe Garibaldi, who briefly overturned the papacy in 1870, wrote, "One cannot secure the support of the people by calling for an overthrow of society, but instead by assuring them that their security will be preserved by the changes we envision." Unquote. Well, not surprisingly, such pragmatic, backward-looking approaches of power-seeking rebels created no new society, and in fact ended up duplicating the regimes they fought. 19th-century European radicals had not read Sun Tzu, nor, for that matter, have most of today's so-called rebels. To establish a new collective identity and chi, we must not resist or combat the old regime, but absorb its own chi. Absorb it, as we did in Canada and at the Vatican. And yet, in practice, old habits of thought and deference prevent even the best of us from doing so consistently on our own terms. I continually experience this within all of the groups I work with. While holding to the vision of a new independent republic based on the common law, our best people will still insist on going into the lawless crown or de facto courts to remedy the latest injustice being done against them or others. They cannot simply turn away from the old regime. Their psychological and energetic dependence on what is familiar runs far deeper within them than they understand, because one's position within the collective symbiosis is largely invisible to the untrained mind. We can't see it. In short, we're all part of a bigger and hidden group mind. The Bible calls it our angel, that can only be nullified by another collective mind. What this means in practice is that regardless of anyone's degree of personal consciousness, everyone seems to be awaiting in trepidation for something or someone else to make the final break and bring in a new regime. Until then, they accommodate and worry about how to protect themselves and others from the present system. It's therefore hardly surprising that our membership within the Republic and common law movement has remained largely a passive and a waiting one, with people's eyes, feet, and every aspect of their life mired in the past, waiting for somebody else's leadership. The only remedy for this immobility is provided collectively through the creation of a new group identity into which we can draw people out of the status quo. And by that moment, when a critical mass is reached, and not only consciousness, but the capacity to act differently emerges among many people. This emergence is always unpredictable, but when it does occur, a huge shift across society happens almost overnight, as history amply demonstrates. And then the new chi arrangement can become an actuality. In many ways, all that we do today is a preparation for the opportunities created by that moment in time, that upcoming window of action, when a new and free society can come into being from the ground up. And to quote Sun Tzu again, "Operations must always be geared to the rapid seizure and exploitation of the key moment of opportunity created in battle, which can never be predicted. The prime purpose of operational commanders is to recognize and act decisively upon such fleeting moments." Unquote. The operational commanders, in our case, are the on-the-ground local community organizers whose job it is to build the movement by empowering wider numbers with the idea and reality that they can govern themselves according to a new and higher law, completely separate from the existing institutions. How to do it? Well, in that regard, the convening of local people's assemblies is an expression of this long struggle to establish new collective chi, because it puts flesh on the idea that fundamental change lies only in our own hands. For as John Adams said in 1791, "The revolution may have been effected first in the hearts and minds of the people, but it took shape in our constitutional conventions, where the people learned how to hold and wield power for themselves." Well, our course of action is clear if the words of John Adams are to become part of our very thought and fiber. We must gather in this united vision into permanent alternative assemblies, where we covenant to establish a new form of law and government. But then the real battle will begin. But let's be clear that by creating such a new authority alongside the old one, by drawing the chi of the old regime into our sphere, we are entering into a state of permanent civil war, both politically and spiritually. We're drawing a line and separating ourselves unalterably from the past by actively disestablishing the thing called Canada and Crown Law, or any corporate regime anywhere in the world that poses as government. The firmer our resolve and the more people we draw into our new common law public and arrangement, the more peaceful will be this transition. We can only undertake this monumental step collectively through a new legal and political framework embodied in the People's Assemblies. For as legislative bodies, these new assemblies can establish legally the common law courts, sheriff groups, and others that will enforce the laws that are the basis of our new society. The people are the source of all law, government, and sovereign authority. This foundational republican principle means that any group of people, no matter how large, who covenant together under an oath, are a legal body and can formulate and pass laws for themselves. That's why the people's assemblies, once convened and operate continually, are the basis of the new republic. But those conventions have to operate according to this higher and alternative chi consciousness. People, especially Canadians, have to learn freedom by beginning to actually practice it and reclaiming their own lost chi autonomy. The assemblies provide a sure way for them to do so on any matter of community concern that can be discussed and resolved locally. When people feel the power of taking all matters into their own hands, and they see how impotent in practice the existing authorities are, the republic will become real as the old regime crumbles. Now, in conclusion, we began by observing how the present global tyranny is an energy-sucking parasite whose ultimate consequence will be the eradication of life as we know it on Mother Earth. Our purpose of shattering that entity and restoring natural law and life to our world cannot be achieved without recognizing and winning back the essential energy that is drained from us every day through our participation in this global machinery of death. Our very thought and action must therefore be geared towards regaining this chi energy by establishing new courts, assemblies, and communities utterly separate from the old institutions to allow people to leave them once and for all. But first, they must leave them in their own minds and hearts. Those of you listeners who will be more than hearers of the word, but doers as well, are like a sharp point of a spear constantly posed for battle. You will create the first wedge through which many others will follow, provided that you remain sharp, clear, and consistent. Because you will form the blueprint of a new society, what you do today and tomorrow is of sacred importance for the future of our people. If you waver or backslide, there will be no such future. For to quote the book of Psalms, number 149, which was cited at the trial of King Charles by the English Parliament in 1649, that established the first common law republic, the book of Psalms wrote and inspires all of us with these words, "For you have been set apart to bind the kings of the earth, and bring to judgment the nobles and the wealthy, and to bring to nothing their pride and their power. This is the task given to the righteous remnant, so that all may know the truth and stand within the justice of God." This is Kevin Annett. I thank you.
I've traveled around this country from shore to shining shore. It really made me wonder the things I heard and saw. I saw the weary farmer, a plough.